Affairs Division will come to order. First thing we'll do here is approve the minutes of the last meeting, and that was for Friday, January 23rd. Do I have a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved.
Is the motion to approve the minutes from January 23rd? Any other discussion on the minutes? Okay. Thank you. Appreciate that. Okay, we have a motion to approve the minutes from January 23rd. Any discussion on the minutes? Okay, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The January 23rd minutes are approved. Okay, today we have with us Brigadier General Kelly and Lieutenant Colonel O'Reilly from the Department of Veterans Affairs, and they're going to give us an overview of the department and tell us a little bit about how things are going there. So, excuse me, from the Department of Military Affairs, you got to get that right. Welcome to both of you, and thank you for coming today, and introduce yourself for the tape, and then go ahead with your presentation.
Mr. Chairman, members, good morning. I am Brigadier General Joe Kelly. I am the Assistant Adjutant General and the Director of the Joint Staff for the Minnesota National Guard.
Good morning, Chairman. I am Lieutenant Colonel Barb O'Reilly. I'm the Chief of Deployment Cycle Support for the National Guard.
All right, thank you.
And Chairman, members, we'll keep the overview relatively simple. And open it for questions. We understood that the committee is interested in our deployment cycle support program, the caring of soldiers and their families as they go to and from war, as well as we also heard some concern about with the pace of deployments that we have today, our ability to respond to emergencies here in the state. So those will be the primary things that we'll address, Mr. Chairman, after the introduction. And I think just by way of an overview, the simplest way to describe it, what's going on with our department, is that we're really busy. These are unprecedented times for us, at least unprecedented as far as the amount of operations tempo that we're sustaining, unprecedented since probably World War II. On Tuesday, the 10th of February, the 34th Infantry Division, which is the senior headquarters, short of the state headquarters here in Minnesota, out of Rosemount, will be deploying, I believe it is 68 years to the day that the 34th Infantry Division deployed for service in World War II. So, not just a coincidence, but it's pretty close to a coincidence. We did a little maneuvering. That will represent 1,100 soldiers that will go to Iraq, be on duty for a year, go to Iraq for approximately 9 months in country, and be responsible for managing 8 of Iraq's 18 provinces. Pretty much from not including Baghdad, but south of Baghdad, that amount of the country, which is roughly the equivalent of the state of Minnesota in square miles, the division will be responsible for. They'll be commanding and controlling up to 4 brigade size units, about 16,000 soldiers and service members from other services will be under their command and control. And they'll be working with the Iraqi security forces, the Iraqi army, the Iraqi police, and the Iraqi border services. This is a pretty significant deployment, in not only in Minnesota history, but in National Guard history. But of course, they're just the latest and the headline that's getting a lot of attention right now. Since 9/11, we have steadily deployed members of the Minnesota Air and Army National Guard. I believe the number on the clicker on the turnstile is probably up around 18,000. So 18,000 Minnesotans have gotten on the bus, if you will, and gone overseas to 33 different countries, including Iraq and Afghanistan, of course, but also everything from Bosnia and Kosovo, where we did significant operations, to, believe it or not, Antarctica, and just about everything in between. While we've had this period of unprecedented deployments, at least as I said, in modern times, Our average, it goes up and down, but our average is about 1,500, or approximately 10% of our force is deployed at any one time now. We've had numbers much higher than that during earlier parts of the conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan. But there are about 14,000 of your fellow Minnesotans in the Minnesota National Guard, about 2,300 in the Air Force, and the balance, about 11,500, are in the Army National Guard. So with those numbers, about 1,500 deployed at any one time. It's interesting, and it's counterintuitive to a lot of people, that during these times of a lot of work, our strength, numbers in our ranks, have steadily and continuously and consistently grown. I looked at some numbers just before I came here, members. In 1995, we had just under 9,000 members in the Minnesota Army National Guard. Today, we have 11,500. So we've had a considerable growth during this time when we've never been working harder. Recruiting and retention have never been better than they've been. Our record years for recruiting, one after the other, are 2004, 2005, 2006, 2007, and now, of course, 2008 and 2009. We're ahead of pace for all those previous years. Because that is one of the most common questions we get. I suppose it's really hard to get people to join the National Guard, given the fact that every time we open a newspaper or turn on the radio or the television, we hear about you coming or going. And that's really not the case. We should all, as Minnesotans, should feel good about that. Because there is a spirit of service and volunteerism and patriotism and a desire to be part of something good and do something bigger than themselves that really shows up in this young generation that are our rank and file soldiers now. So we're very busy, but we're strong and growing strong. We're ready, and not only to support the needs of the Army and the Air Force overseas, but also to be that governor's emergency response force here in the state of Minnesota. Of course, we had some got some press time during the Republican National Convention when we had approximately 1,300 National Guard soldiers and about another 400 active duty personnel that worked in support of the St. Paul Police Department and the U.S. Secret Service to provide security for the convention. And for the inaugural, on about 48 hours' notice, we deployed 325 soldiers to go out and be a reaction force in case something bad happened during the inauguration. Of course, fortunately they didn't. But I think it demonstrates the ability of your National Guard to stand up soldiers and airmen very quickly when they're needed, not only here in Minnesota, elsewhere in the country and around the world. So, Mr. Chairman, that's subject to any questions, of course. That's a general overview of what's happening in the Minnesota Air and Army National Guard today.
Okay. Any questions, members, at this point? Okay. Representative Detmer.
Yeah, just a comment. You know, I get a Department of Defense newsletter like once a month, and right now, currently, we have about 124,000 nationwide reserve component soldiers that are on active duty right now, and about 96,000 of those make up the Army National Guard and reserve components. So. And then you have your other reserve components too, branches. I do have one question. I have a constituent coming in visiting today. He's a retired Colonel Ron Malcolm, and a personal friend of mine. And he wants to know what can citizens do to provide support for our soldiers when they're men and women when they're deployed, and what's the best point of contact for them if they would like to send care packages or do things for these men and women that are serving. What's the best point of contact for them?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Detmer, that's probably the second most common question we get after how is recruiting going. And it's an excellent question, and we're grateful for the support that we feel from the public during these times when we're really working hard. The simplest answer, and probably the best answer, And we're living in the 21st century, so I'm going to give you a website. It's Minnesota National Guard, all one word, doesn't matter about capitalization. MinnesotaNationalGuard.org. And when you go to the homepage, down the left-hand column, there's a banner that says, "How can I help?" And if you simply click on there, it takes you to a number of other places to include everything from how to donate money to the Minnesota Military Family Foundation or the Military Appreciation Fund or the First Lady's website for donating time and kind. So if you want to donate your time, some goods, or some money, if you click on MinnesotaNationalGuard.org, how can I help? It really does give them a roadmap. The other advice, representative, that I might give them is go to the local armory or reserve center or the airbase and ask someone there, particularly working in the family assistance center, the family readiness group, how can I help? We don't turn away help because we can use it. We can use it all. So that's probably the best answer. And we don't just take care of the Minnesota National Guard. It's sort of like the whole reintegration program that I hope Colonel O'Reilly gets a chance to talk about. We take care of all soldiers, airmen, sailors, Marines, Coast Guardsmen, active reserve guard. We're here to serve all those. So that's a good portal, though, because we are the largest military formation that's present here in Minnesota.
Thank you. Thank you.
Anything further? Okay. Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think Lieutenant Colonel O'Reilly is going to address the reintegration. That's kind of where my line of questioning is going to go. Forward.
Representative Fowles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize for getting here a little late, so maybe you covered this before, but my question is, I've heard that as a percentage, the Minnesota National Guard has one of the highest deployment rates of any state National Guard. If that is true, and like I said, I've heard that from several sources, so I hope that is the case, why is that? Is it that we are more ready than other units, or we're just lucky, or why is that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Fowles, members, I don't know that that's entirely accurate. I think our deployment experience or rate, if you will, is above average, but it's not way off the chart. The way we try to calculate that is we look at, here's the number of soldiers we have, and we then do the math. We got 11,500 today in the Army, divided by 18,000 deployment experiences, and you end up with a 1-point-something. That's really slightly above average, but not much beyond. The statistic that often gets maybe confused with that or associated with that is the Minnesota Army National Guard is the sixth largest National Guard in the country. And as a state, we rank about 21st in population. So in a lot of ways, Minnesota is fighting above its weight. We've got six versus 21. So if you take it that way, Minnesota is doing more than its fair share. But when you compare it to the number of service members that we have and the number of times we've deployed, we're just slightly above average. So depending on how people characterize those numbers, representative, is probably how that comes. We do have some unique force structure units in Minnesota. The division headquarters, there's only 8 of those in the National Guard. There's only 18 of those in the Army. So when they need one, the chances are, if you're the good one, in the case of the 34th, they happen to be the best one, the most ready, the most capable, you're going to get called. So that's a complicated answer to a simple and fair question, but we are doing, Minnesota as a whole is doing its fair share and then some. There's no doubt. But it's nothing that causes us alarm where we feel that our soldiers and airmen are being treated unfairly or deployed in an unfair pace.
Anything further, members? Representative Newton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. General Kelly, how many Guard or Reserve divisions are there in the United States, you know?
I'm sorry?
How many divisions are there?
Of the
Guard or Reserve?
In the National Guard, there's 8 combat divisions. There are 10 combat divisions on active duty. The reserve, I don't know, Representative. I can get back to you. The reserve has a different structure. They have training divisions and training support divisions that do what the name says. They train and prepare soldiers for either their specialty or to go to war. So they're not a deployable division. They would not take that unit overseas as such. But they do have that structure, but I don't know the exact number of Army Reserve divisions.
Thank you. Okay. Representative Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sir, how is the retention factor both in the enlisted ranks and the officers? And is there still a lot of involuntary release if they're bypassed in grade?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Leader, and I'll ask Colonel O'Reilly to chip in a little here. She used to work in our recruiting and retention command, and she also worked in our personnel shop, so she might have some insight a little different. Retention overall is within normal limits. It is not high, but it's not low. On average, we expect to turn over between 18% and 20% of our force in a given year, and we're right at those numbers. You know, sometimes we do better, sometimes we do worse. So it's within normal limits. For officers and enlisted folks, probably the only areas of concern we have there is that when soldiers get up to right around that 20 year, which is somewhat of a mid grade, they're majors, lieutenant colonels, they're senior non-commissioned officers. A lot of them, particularly if they've done a deployment or two, are saying, "Okay, at 20 years, that's enough." So we've had some mid-grade attrition that's a little bit higher than we've had in the past. As far as a up or out policy, there is no policy on the enlisted side. On the officer side, that is you only have so much time you can serve in each grade. We have not run into a problem with involuntary separation, Representative. Nor, because it's usually a follow-on question, we don't have a great deal of difficulty with the stop-loss issue as well, which the Department of Defense is walking away from. I don't know, does that answer your question, Representative?
Representative.
Sure. Thank you. But it used to be when they got about 18 years, they'd get bumped out involuntarily, and that was critical with the Guard. That doesn't happen that often anymore.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, no. And Colonel, can you?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, no, that doesn't. Actually, once we get somebody to 18 years, that's a pretty safe place for them to be, because we know that they're going to stay in for the next 2 at least to get their 20. But I think maybe you're referring to a reduction in force type activity, and that we're not experiencing right now. If that answers your question.
It appeared that I don't think it was reduction in force. I think it's just they probably were overstrength in the TO&E in a particular grade, and like a captain couldn't make major. And I know, in fact, I knew quite a few people that way, and that would get bumped and just released.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I think you're speaking more of, back in the day when, as General Kelly said, we're suffering from a little bit of loss at that mid to senior grade. And so because of that, in part, we definitely do not have a problem promoting up to the next grade. So very, very few would meet the time and grade requirements where they would have to be bumped.
Okay, thank you. Anything further? Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to that point, particularly for, both officer and enlisted, if you hit the 18-year mark, there's a statute that was instituted called Sanctuary that basically allows, once you get inside that 18-year mark, you cannot be released unless you specifically request to be released. So it allows people to go to that sanctuary. A few years ago, we had a force driven, which was they kind of call it the rat going through the snake, where there was a large number of personnel and they had some downsizing going on. And because of that, there was some attrition that was instituted. But those were early out policies that actually allowed the individuals at between 15 years to and 20 years to get an early retirement. It was a reduced percentage, but it was a foreshaping policy. And then the normal policies for those are typically for the officer corps in particular and the enlisted, is they have a ratcheting down or a reduced percentage of people that are able to go to the next rank. I think for a lieutenant it's like 75%, you go to a major it goes to about 50%, then to a lieutenant colonel or commander goes to about 15%, and I think captain is around 10, but that would be to the colonel. But it's kind of a great structure because you don't get real top heavy. You're always leaning out your leadership, and the best ones are always moving forward. So it's kind of one of those things that I really wish our educational system would go to. You know, where you have some type of term limits where you actually get into the thing, and you have the leaders who are staying in, and they're mentoring the ones that are lower in the ranks. And it's not unionized, obviously. And it's a strong, it produces a strong force. And so those are, you know, some force shaping tools that have taken place in the past, but typically it's a healthy system.
Okay, thank you, Representative Severson. Representative, I just want to make a comment. Representative Leader and I are from the Brown Boot Army, and things have changed so much since then. I know I was I retired in 1978, and I was recalled in 93. And I was surprised to see the change that had taken place, where the Guard and Reserve at one time was sort of a sanctuary, especially during the Vietnam era, if you didn't want to go to combat. And the roles have changed, where the active military now is providing the support, and in many cases it's the Guard and Reserve that are providing the soldiers on the ground. So it's changed over years, and you and I were in about the same time, so it has changed a lot.
Anything further, members? Okay.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just comment on Representative Newton's remarks. He's exactly right. 30 years ago, when I joined the National Guard, we were considered a strategic reserve. We were there to, as one guy put it one day, we were going to be used in the late innings of World War III. That was how the Department of Defense looked at its reserve forces. That you'd have a year to call them up and train them and fill up their ranks and give them their equipment. So no big deal during peacetime. Don't need to worry about it. Well, now we have become part of the operational force of the Army and the Air Force, and the same is true of the reserve components in the Marines and the Navy, where we are part of a rotational force that has to be employed overseas in order for the United States military to do its job. So it has changed dramatically over a generation or two. But we are back to brown boots, if you notice. No boot polish anymore. We say it's because we're so busy we don't have time to polish boots right now, so we went to suede. So.
Good. Anything further? Okay, continue.
At this point, Mr. Chairman, with your permission, I'll just ask Colonel O'Reilly to generally describe what's going on in the program that you know by a number of names, Beyond the Yellow Ribbon, Reintegration, Deployment Cycle Support, which is our program to take care of soldiers and their families as they go to and from combat deployments, and which has been supported well by our state legislature. So, Colonel?
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you, General Kelly. Yes, during this time of unprecedented deployments, it is also a time of unprecedented support by the communities, by people. There's an outpouring of support for the military and our military families. Everybody seems to want to know what they can do to support us. When we started reintegration, I think was the main focus. How can we help the soldiers when they come home, ensuring that they're able to adjust, get back to normal, if you will. And as we have evolved, we have recognized the old saying, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And so we have developed many different programs that help those service members and their families throughout the entire deployment cycle. We now, you know, there are many different numbers as to how many phases of a deployment cycle there might be. In Minnesota, we have stuck to 3 phases. We're trying to keep it as simple as we can, but we're doing as much as we can. One of the first things we do is we focus on family readiness and the family readiness groups. That is, the family readiness groups are there to support the service members' families throughout a deployment cycle. About twice a year, we conduct a training session called our Family Readiness Planning Committee, Planning Conference, in which we bring unit representatives, and members of the family readiness group, the family readiness group leaders, and we talk to them about what they can do to plan to support the families while the service members are gone. We ask the unit and the family readiness group to work together to develop their action plan on how they are going to support family members while the unit is deployed. From that, we have a family preparation academy. This is really the first phase of our program after the unit is notified. Approximately 90 days before the unit is deployed, we have the family readiness or the family planning conference. We just conducted the family planning conference for the division in December, and we just finished the family planning conference for the 101-151 in Marshall two weekends ago. I have to say that I believe that this is the most important thing that we're doing for families, because it gives, the focus at this conference is really on the family members, preparing them for how they are going to steady the canoe after the service member has jumped out. We give them basic resources. We actually bombard them with information throughout 10 different seminars throughout the day. They're able to choose which ones they go to depending upon their individual needs. And our hope is that we give them enough information that if they do have a problem somewhere in the deployment, they'll remember back, they'll refer to our resources, and be able to resolve their issues. We also introduce them to the Family Assistance Center. And I kind of take my role as the commander is charged to take care of the service members. My role is I'm charged to take care of the family members, and the Family Assistance Center is really the squad leader or the platoon leader. It's the first-line leader for the families. So we connect those, because the Family Assistance Center has access to all resources. Family member needs something, they call the Family Assistance Center, which we call the FAC, and they're referred to help. We also have family readiness groups that are formed from, typically it's the spouses, the family members of the deployed soldiers or the deployed service members. And throughout the deployment cycle, we offer training for them. We offer opportunities for them to get together, connect, network. The next thing that we will do for the families, the next formal training event, is the family reintegration event. And that occurs about 90 days before the unit is ready to come home. We're going to be doing this for the CAB unit in April. And then we're going to, again, bring in the family members and say to them, give them some training on what they can expect when the family member comes home. We're going to offer some coping skills and just really get them prepared for what will happen after that initial honeymoon phase is over. And then, of course, there is the 30, 60, 90-day reintegration event. The 30-day reintegration event focuses on relationships, and the 60-day event focuses more on coping skills and overcoming any issues that they might have. Throughout both of these events, we have providers from many different organizations, state and local and federal organizations, who are there giving service members information that is going to directly assist them. It will provide a resource, or maybe in some cases it puts money in their pockets, and they're always happy when that happens. In addition to these events, we also focus on wounded warriors, and we will have 2 wounded warrior conferences throughout the year. The first one is to provide, again, basic information for the wounded warrior. because the needs of the wounded warrior are different from that of a normal service member coming home. The second Wounded Warrior Conference will help them to adjust to their life, adjust to the injury, overcome that injury. And again, throughout all of these events, we focus not only on the National Guard, although that is our largest customer, but we have worked with the Marine Corps, the Navy, the Army Reserve, and the Air Force Reserve and Air Force National Guard, of course, to try to bring them into our event. I would say that they are most successful, we've been most successful getting them to come to our Wounded Warrior conferences because we've actually found the way to have the reserve component order them to come. So that's a very good thing. So, pending your questions, Chairman.
Members, Representative Demers.
Yes, ma'am. How many of these programs came about since the Desert Storm?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I believe that they have all come about since Desert Storm.
Mm-hmm.
We did a little, or one of my counterparts did some research, and he said that there were reintegration activities during the Second World War, that those were largely done by church groups.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't believe there has been really any formal reintegration or family preparation since then.
And Mr. Chairman, I'd like to point out to the committee here, you know, the National Guard has really been a big force behind providing these programs, the family support groups or the family readiness groups for our men and women. I can just tell you a personal experience. When I was mobilized after 9/11 for 20 months, my unit was down in Fort Gordon, Georgia, and I could have been just as well out of the country, so my family was up here. So these family support groups are very important. I know my wife went ahead and started her own support group, and people came and wanted to be part of that. So these any things we can do to support the families, and I think what we're doing in the current programs is just outstanding for our men and women.
Good. Representative Beaverton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Colonel O'Reilly, can you speak to some of the issues, I think, in terms of reintegration for employment purposes? You know, we're asking our civilian sector to step up to the plate with multiple deployments, and that can cause some consternation, I think, in the civil sector, but also in the state sector. There's one bill that we had a study done on, actually that we've had a study done on veterans preference, and we're trying to find out how many veterans are actually in state government. That's one aspect of it, and the feelings are that if we're asking our civilian employees to step up to the plate, then state government ought to be either leading the way or at least even, and we're finding that's not necessarily the case. But I wanted to. I received an email from a gentleman who's in the Guard, and he had encouraged me to put this bill back in because he had gone to MnDOT, and MnDOT had interviewed him for the job, one of the few state jobs in his area. And when they found out he was a Guard member, they basically turned it off and hired someone else. So I'm wondering if you have any reporting criteria within the Guard itself that queries these individuals to find out if they are having problems finding reemployment. And I know there's provisions out there, but how responsive are our soldiers to actually coming back and reporting that so that we can actually, you know, address those issues from the legislature here?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes, employment is one of the largest problems that service members experience as they come home. Employment and relationships, and probably they're both very closely related. We have an organization called Employer Support of the Guard and Reserve that does track the number of cases. I cannot tell you at this time how many cases that they're currently working on. However, their job is very much reactive. If a service member is having an issue obtaining reemployment or they feel that they were not hired due to their status in the military, they have the opportunity to speak to ESGR which is employer support of the Guard and Reserve, and then ESGR will send an ombudsman to the employer to determine if there is actual either violation or potential violation of the USERRA law, which requires a service member to be able to go back to the same type of position that they had at the same pay grade. However, what we're trying to do right now is take a more proactive approach. Again, knowing that employment is one of the largest problems that service members are going to face. And so we're starting to really reach out to the employers, ask them what we can do in order for them to sustain their support of the military and the citizen soldier. Secondly, we're asking them to take a look at what we're doing for their employees. As for example, let's say that Target has a forklift driver. He goes and he deploys, and at the time of his deployment, he is now a squad leader. He is in a mid-level or a low-level management position. He is supervising people in life and death situations. He is supervising or in charge of maybe millions of dollars worth of equipment. And so as a result of his experience in the military, we are actually returning to Target a better employee than what they had. And so that is one point that we're trying to get employers to understand. We are not, we may be taking your employees, but in the meanwhile, we are providing them training that they're not going to get anywhere else. Service members know how to respond to a mission. They know how to accomplish a mission. They're able to look at the bigger picture. And so really, that is what we're trying to work with employers so they understand. In addition, we are trying to work with the Department of Economic and Employment Development and ensure that they are offering job fairs. That is one of our goals for the 90-day reintegration period for the division, is to be at the point where we actually have a job fair for our service members when they come home. So they're going back not only to the same job, if that's what they want, but they have the opportunity to move up. Does that answer your question?
100%.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Colonel. That answers some of it. I guess one of the issues I wanted to maybe bring before this committee is last year when we had put the bill through for veterans' preference, we had kind of stepped back and said, maybe we need to take a look, particularly at the state level, to see what kind of employment numbers we actually have. MMB came back with a report, and I'm wondering if at some point we might be able to have that report come before this body to really take a hard look at this. The numbers that I saw in the initial one kind of validated my concerns, was that we are not employing at the state level a number of veterans that is commensurate with the redeployment and some of those opportunities, and we are having a declining number. The MMB report came back, and the interpretation of that was a little different, but I think we could, if we had them before us, we could probably get to the core of the issue. Dealing again with veterans' preference that changed significantly in 1975 and really took the teeth out of it, to address the issue that we have veterans, we have military people that are coming back and looking for jobs, not able to find jobs, and are being turned away from the very support group that ought to be doing, leading the way, and that's the state government and local jobs. Mr. Chair, hopefully we'll be able to, I'd like to talk with you offline on that, and maybe we could set up a hearing for that. That would be appreciated. But I appreciate all of the reintegration. I know that Chaplain Morris has been a huge pioneer in this whole process on the national level, and really the Minnesota National Guard has been a leader in this whole process, and I'm very proud to see you guys do what you do for our soldiers.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Vick, if I could comment, I just returned from a deployment cycle support conference in St. Louis, which occurred this past week, and yes, Minnesota is recognized as the leader in reintegration, but we know that we have so much more to do to take care of service members and their families. We're looking around and seeing what else there is to do.
Sure. Thank you. Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe just to piggyback on the employment issue, the education issue. I know many soldiers and men and women find out that there's lots to offer with the Montgomery GI Bill and now the Minnesota GI Bill. Do you see any concerns, men and women coming back and getting reintegrated into their college or university systems and you know, is there any problems there that we need to be aware of?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, one of the things that many soldiers do do want to do when they return, because of all the education benefits that they have as a result of not only their deployment, but the fantastic support of the Minnesota State Legislature, is go to school. They want to improve their state and life. We have taken a very proactive approach by placing liaisons at, last count I believe was in the 30s, General?
I think so. Yeah.
We have 30 liaisons throughout many of the higher education schools throughout Minnesota. And so they are there as service members are having concerns. We're also taking a very proactive approach by reaching out to educators and asking them to be aware of the issues that service members have as they're coming home, because a service member is maybe a little bit different from the normal 18-year-old, and so we just ask them to understand the different issues that they may be facing as opposed to the normal student.
Good. Thank you.
Representative Newton. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question regarding medical screening for the military when they come back. One of the figures I saw recently was there's some 230,000 service members returning who have traumatic brain damage of some sort. That's nationwide. So are we screening people who have been in areas where there have been IEDs or any sort of concussion could occur but isn't readily apparent? Are they getting the medical screening for that? And also, are they getting screening for PTSD?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes, every service member who comes home at the redeployment base or installation, they will go through screening. However, I would say that many service members, if they had any problems, that's not the time they're going to divulge that information, because the largest concern is, I want to go home. So they're afraid that if they do divulge the information, that they will be forced to stay longer. So at the 90-day reintegration event, there is an additional screening process that gives the service member the opportunity to talk about any medical or psychological mental health injuries that they may have sustained while they're in theater. It does ask specific questions in regard to whether you were exposed to anything that may cause future damage, such as smoke, or they ask the regions that you've been in. They ask specifically if you were in an IED or had any head injuries throughout the deployment. Also, it does not specifically, you know, ask whether you feel that you have signs of PTSD. I think that we are learning that the signs and symptoms of TBI, traumatic brain injury, and PTSD may not occur for many months. And so we need to be able to continually look at soldiers and ask them if they are having problems. That is one thing that has been, I think, especially difficult for students and maybe even employers to understand. A soldier or a service member who has a traumatic brain injury maybe has some very difficult challenges because of their ability to remember. There was one police officer who noted that he had to retrain. It was like, I had to retrain this soldier every day. This soldier suffered from a traumatic brain injury. What he really needed was, he needed the Palm Pilot so he could remember what he was supposed to do. He needs coaching skills. So that he can reintegrate into school and employment. PTSD, I think the numbers are, we're at about 18% nationwide. I don't think that PTSD is the problem that maybe it's perceived to be in the past.
It sounds to me, Colonel, that this has to be soldier initiated, that if the service member comes forward and indicates that he has something wrong. Is there a routine medical screening that they all go through initially, and then maybe after 60 days or 6 months?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes. It is at the demobilization post when they immediately come home, and then secondly at the 90-day period. In addition, if they were in a rollover or had a brain injury, that should be annotated in their records from the event that occurred in country. Yes, it needs to be soldier initiated, but in addition, we are teaching the signs and symptoms of traumatic brain injury and PTSD and other psychological mental health type injuries at our reintegration events. So the spouses, the family members can also recognize these symptoms and can assist the service members in coming forward. According to one of the county veteran service officers, she said that more family members are coming in with the service member now than ever before to report the injuries.
Mr. Chair, if I could just add comment to maybe amplify that it is a fairly formal process that we track the health of our soldiers pre and post deployment. When they go through a soldier readiness processing on their way out, one of the things they go through is a pretty thorough physical evaluation and documentation. And the easiest one to understand is everybody gets a hearing test. And I'm going to check your hearing and record it before you go to war, so that if you come back and say, I can't hear now, we can compare it to what your hearing level was before. And that's just one example that's easy to understand. Colonel O'Reilly accurately talked about the demobilization site and the reintegration event. It is called a post-deployment health risk assessment that is done at the 90-day event, and I think again at 180, I can't recall. But we do, at the initial reintegration, that when we have them back in Minnesota, we specifically address traumatic brain injury, and every soldier gets a card to answer some specific questions about what their experience was. On top of that, ongoing after that, every year we have what's called an annual health assessment, where every soldier speaks to, goes through, answers questions, and goes through a screening process and has the opportunity to talk to a medical professional. And our docs now and our medical professionals, as they've now become part of this, look for and are better tuned into looking for some of the symptoms of everything from hearing loss to TBI to PTSD. So we are, I would say, representative on a very continuous basis, assessing the health of our folks and always watchful for those things.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to thank you because I know from 23 years of experience in the military that a lot of soldiers have something that they know is wrong, and they don't come forward to let people know, partially because it's their career. So I'm glad that you're doing the screening, that you keep following up on it. Thank you very much. Representative Doty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know from speaking to several Guard members in my own district that the mental health and other issues are being addressed much, much better than in the past. This past week, I heard a very disturbing news report on national news about the suicide rate among military, and I'm sure that you pay very close attention to that. And so my question is really not about the post-deployment, but even during. And I know that these statistics can, you know, there can be spikes up and down at any time, and maybe this is just an aberration, but are we paying more attention during service to people now, too?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Doty, yes, because the number one killer, if you will, of soldiers throughout the military system, including combat, is suicide. So we have extensive suicide prevention training that goes on an annual basis for leaders. It certainly gets ramped up because during deployment, because you're looking for different things when you have soldiers deployed overseas. So it is a huge point of concern for the leadership of the military across the board. We are building
suicide prevention into a wider campaign of what we call Protect Our Force, which includes suicide prevention, drug and alcohol abuse, sexual assault and harassment, and those types of things. It's a campaign we're building right now, but suicide is one of the primary planks in it. Statistically, since 9/11, which seems to be the date from which everything gets measured in these times, the Minnesota National Guard, I think, has had 2 suicides of our members. None of them were when they were in a duty status, and I don't believe that either of them had been a deployer, had come back from an overseas deployment. But because it is the number one killer, even ahead of combat and motorcycle accidents, it's a huge concern.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, to add to that, we currently have ongoing training to all of our E5 sergeants and above, specifically related to psychological first aid and helping those leaders identify those signs and symptoms and those soldiers that may be at risk.
Okay. Representative Billy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know that this is always a difficult topic to deal with, whether it's military or outside of the military, and your answers were very good answers. Thank you.
Okay. Anything further, members? Excuse me. See, I have a question for either of you, and maybe both of you. The ability or frequency of communication between deployed military personnel and their families, I understand it's pretty good nowadays with technology and everything that's available, but if you could comment on that and on what's available.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members, it is amazingly good in these times. If you compare that experience of what our soldiers go through today, which where they truly do have, if they want, can probably have daily access to their family by email or by phone, or in some cases video teleconference. In fact, we facilitated a wedding yesterday from a deployed, I don't even know what branch of the service the groom was from, but his wife was back here in Minnesota. Through video teleconferencing, one of our chaplains married a soldier in Djibouti. So the technology is amazing, and when you compare that that almost daily contact, if you want it, to World War II, Korea, Vietnam, where you'd write a letter to your mother, throw it on the supply truck, and it might be 45 days or never that letter got to your back to your family. So sometimes commanders worry that too much contact is a bad thing. My personal opinion is that if you don't want a soldier who's going out on patrol to be worried about whether the guy showed up to fix the washing machine back in White Bear Lake. But that is a better problem to deal with than not knowing, and the fear of the unknown, and the feeling of detachment from family, from spouse, from children, from being able to help in some way with what's going on. So the communications, I think, is dramatic. And I'll ask Barb to comment, because she was in Afghanistan, where it's a little bit austere than where I was in Iraq, infrastructure-wise.
Chairman, representatives, yes, a little bit more austere, but even in Afghanistan, where there are locations that helicopters cannot even reach, there was great access to mail. The mail was reliable and predictable. I was part of the postal unit, and so I know. Put a plug in for that postal. So, I think that even then, soldiers were getting mail every 7 days. And so we know that at least when they don't have access to the computers where they can get daily email, and certainly in those more austere locations, they do not have access to email. They don't even have access to telephones until they come back into their forward operating base. And but they would definitely get mail at least every 7 days. We ensured that the cookies were fresh. So it's good. I would also add that webcam is a phenomenal resource that is now available to service members and families so they can stay in touch.
Good, thank you.
Chairman, if I could, I would like to revisit Representative Severson's question about some practical things, perhaps, where we need some support or continued support, particularly with regard to jobs and education. The employment thing is an incredibly complicated issue, particularly in the economic environment that we're in today. But with the economy and the fact that people change when they go through a combat deployment, they come home and they're different. That's what reintegration is all about, is adjusting to the changes that have happened in you and your family. And a lot of times it manifests itself in employment and in education. I can't go back to, and I don't want to insult anybody's vocation here, but I can't go back to driving that truck, seeing those kids in that classroom, working at the bank. I've changed. I need to do something else. I want to go to college to learn how to do this or that or the other. So in there become two of the real important things we need your continued support. One is that those basic reemployment protections. And we don't have a big problem. There's often, though, some more of an insidious bias against soldiers who might have to deploy again, but it's hard to identify. But those basic job protections, I think veterans' preference is in strengthening that would be incredibly important, because after family relationships, meaningful, productive employment is the biggest issue for getting back to normal, whatever normal is for people after they return. So basic job protections, reemployment, and veterans' preference, I think, would be very helpful. With regard to resources and colleges, the Minnesota State Tuition Reimbursement Program that the legislature has so generously resourced over the years is the envy of many of our peers across the country. And it's incredibly important now, if you accept what I said earlier about the importance of education and jobs. I don't know exactly this morning where we're at, but at some point in time, you know, we need everyone in the legislature to keep an eye on the funding levels in that tuition reimbursement program, because that's an incredibly important benefit to us. Not only for this purpose, but I would tell you that program has increased the quality of our soldiers and airmen. I can't even quantify it, from guys like me that joined 30 years ago to the quality of the young men and women who are joining today. Many to most of them are college or technical school bound. They are smart kids, they have a plan for their life, and they're willing to serve their country and work hard to get it. I always use the example of, it's a really good thing when the kid driving your tank is a third-year chemistry major at the University of Minnesota. He's not going to have any problems doing his job. So I don't know that everybody appreciates how the quality and the education and the intelligence and the overall people have improved through that tuition incentive program. So I ask you to keep an eye on that. You asked about the experience of soldiers coming back and going to colleges, trying to get back in step with that. The University of Minnesota, the Minsky system, and the private colleges have all, I think, really stepped up. And they just need to make, we need your help to make sure they continue to have the ability to do that, because I'm amazed how busy they are, because soldiers and airmen really need to, they have different needs, and they need to be able to talk to somebody who understands what it is that they're going through as they try to pick back up, get back in step with their life. Think about a kid who was a freshman, got mobilized, went overseas, and comes back. Well, his buddies are juniors or seniors, and he's just going to start his sophomore year. And, oh, by the way, he changed while he was gone. The rules have changed. Finances have changed. So they need somebody who is prepared and focused on helping veterans with their resumption of their college careers when they come back. So whatever this committee and the legislature writ large can do to help help those colleges and universities and technical schools maintain the ability to man those veteran service centers it's critical, because that's the pathway to the happy rest of the life for most of our soldiers.
Okay, good. Anything else, members? Either of you have anything further?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I would just add that some of the efforts that we're doing in the Yellow Ribbon Communities and the Yellow Ribbon Counties campaign, which is kind of the outpouring or the product of the Military Family Covenant, which the governor signed back in June, is trying to empower those communities and get all of those organizations, the key leaders throughout the communities who want to do something. We're trying to synchronize them and get them organized in order to further support their service members and the families throughout the deployment cycle. One of our key partners in that campaign is the University of Minnesota, the Center for Democracy and Citizenship with the Warriors to Citizen Committee, and that has been a fantastic partner to help us continue the efforts. We kind of get them excited when we talk to them that it's the Warriors to Citizen Committee who really is able to enable and promote those grassroots efforts.
Okay, good. Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you just briefly just discuss your thoughts on many schools, high schools have junior ROTC programs. Do you have anything you can share with us on those types of programs for schools, high schools?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I do know that many of the schools have junior ROTC programs. We like them as a recruiting force. They tend to bring us some very well-prepared young men and women to be in the National Guard. I think that they are a benefit because what they do is it kind of provides an outward network for those other young men and women whose parents or friends' parents may be involved in a deployment. So I think it's a natural network. I have no data to support me, but I just have a feeling that those might be helpful in providing a resource for the other youth.
Thank you.
Sir, Mr. Chairman, members, my last comments would one be thank you. Thanks for the opportunity to come and talk to you this morning. And the other would be I hope you're proud, not of me and O'Reilly here. Our mothers take care of that. but proud of your National Guard. Proud that it's at 120% of what it's required to have. Proud that it's pulling its weight and then some with the overseas deployments and the work that this country needs done. Proud of the fact that this reintegration program and everything that Colonel O'Reilly talked about, that's made in Minnesota. That was a program that started in General Shalito's head, went into Chaplain Morris's heart, and got out in the rest of us. That was an idea, that was a pilot program that was supported by the governor, the legislature, and our congressional delegation, that became a $400 million a year, not that we're bragging about the price tag, Department of Defense-wide program for taking care of reserve component members and their families after they come home. Because back to Representative Detmer's question, no, there was nothing like this after Korea, after Vietnam, and Desert Storm. But it was made here in Minnesota because General Shalito, as a combat infantryman from Vietnam, said, I remember what it felt like when I came home, and we're not doing that. We have to help these folks different. So you should be very proud of this program, Minnesota, because we are very grateful for your support of it. So we thank you for the ongoing support of our state legislature.
Good. Well, General Kelly and Colonel O'Reilly, we're pleased you were here today, and thank you for showing up. We took note of the things that you mentioned that we should watch as legislators and appreciate that. We appreciate that two-way communication. Also, so you know that this is a good committee, by the way, that we've done a lot of good things the last couple of years, and it's just a good group again this year. The makeup's a little different, but we've got quite a few of the same members back. But anyway, we appreciate all the work of the military personnel and their families, their sacrifice there too, which we fully understand. And also to the two of you as individuals, to thank you for your service also. And thanks again for coming here today. Anything else, members? All right, we're adjourned.